John is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10.
This is Sound Opinions Presents Like a Rolling Stone, the music of Bob Dylan. I'm Jim DeRogatis, my co-host is Greg Kot, and we're going to turn now to that magical period where Bob Dylan plugs in and goes electric.
Yeah, Jim, it was an extraordinary period of time between March 1965 and June of 1966. It's pretty hard to imagine any other rock performer of the last half century having a better 15 months Bob Dylan had. He completely changed the game. You know, everybody says he went electric. Well, what does that mean, really? I think there was a number of things happening for Dylan here. First of all, he was broadening his reach as a songwriter. We saw that near the end of the folk period with songs like Mr. Tambourine Man, where he was going for a more poetic, symbolic imagery in his songs. But also as a musician, here's a guy who always had his antenna up, and he was paying close attention to what was going on in England at the time. I mean, the Beatles blew his mind. He didn't see them as a bubblegum pop group the way some of the hardcore folkies did. He saw them as the next wave. This was not a snap judgment on his part. I mean, he had rock and roll in his DNA. He was a huge Little Richard fan growing up in northern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. He saw some of these people play, and now he was ready to embrace the next wave. He was ready to incorporate that symbolic, poetic imagery of his songs and wed it with rock and roll. And so it produced this extraordinary run of albums, bringing it all back home in 1965, which was half electric and half acoustic. Later on that year, Highway 61 revisited, an all-electric album, and then the capstone, the double album, Blonde on Blonde, in June of 66.
Greg, as you said, rock and roll was always part of Bob Dylan's makeup, and now it's coming to the fore. One of the men by his side in helping him realize that was Al Kooper, rock and roll zealot and a legendary musician in his own right.
Al was with Dylan during one of the most famous or infamous rock concerts in history, the day that Dylan changed rock and roll in a lot of ways, July 25th, 1965, the Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island. That festival was founded, remember, by Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, and Dylan had appeared there in folk mode the previous 2 years to great acclaim. But in 65, as a headliner, he plugged in for the first time. So let's start there. Al, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Nice to be back.
Now, Al, a lot's been written about that show. You were there. Most of the focus has been on the fact that during the set, Dylan was booed by the crowd. Booing that would follow him and the band throughout his tour for the next year. But you tell it differently than a lot of the history books. You say it was overblown that Dylan was booed.
He wasn't booed.
Yeah. Tell us exactly what happened.
Well, the concept of him playing electric was sort of conjured up a couple of days before the show. And I actually had bought tickets and went to the show. I used to go every year. It was like sort of a social thing. It was Facebook for the summer back in those days. So there I was, and I was walking around in the afternoon, and I bumped into Albert Grossman, who was Bob's manager at the time. And he said, Bob is looking for you. Why don't you meet us back here tonight? Here's some passes. So I hooked up with Bob, and he said that he wanted to play live, and would I play with him? He wanted to play with a band. And he was going to use Butterfield's band, but he wanted me to play with them. I said, sure, sounds like fun. And we had just finished doing the album. Maybe we were 2 weeks after we did the album, something like that.
Highway 61 Revisited.
Yeah. So, you know, it was fresh in my mind and everything. The night before, Saturday night, because we played on a Sunday, we had a rehearsal at one of those, like, millionaires' mansions in Newport. The Butterfield band was not the right band to do that with. And so we only got three songs rehearsed that we could play. So Bob was headlining the festival, and a lot of college kids came, you know, just to see him and, like, sat through all this, what they thought was bizarre music, just to hear Dylan. The average set was between 45 minutes and an hour. And we came out, and first of all, we played electric, which was bizarre for Newport. And then we only played for 15 minutes because we only had three songs rehearsed. What caused the fracas. Here's the headliner of the festival and he plays only a quarter as long as everybody else has played. People didn't like that. And as I walked off stage, I caught a conversation between Bob and Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul and Mary, who was the MC of the show that night. And he said, where are you going? What are you doing? He said, we only know three songs. He said, well, why don't you play some acoustic songs? He says, I don't have an acoustic guitar with me. He said, well, take mine. You can't just leave them like that. And he said, okay. And then he went out and played what I thought was the best part of the whole show. Was he played It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. Good choice.
Yeah.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fast. He understands you're orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
It was like a really amazing moment. It was an amazing thing to see. But booing, no booing.
Yeah. They were just disappointed, and they wanted him to play longer. It was not a case of, boo, you're going electric and selling out the whole folk movement, which is the mythology going around in most of the history books.
Well, I know why that happened. It's because the press was aware of a problem between, you know, the board of governors and Albert Grossman about the fact that Dylan was playing electric. During Saturday afternoon, the Butterfield Band played a set in the afternoon, and they were introduced by Alan Lomax, and he made reference to the fact that they were playing electric and that was not a good thing. Just to the left of the stage, Albert Grossman and Alan Lomax had a fist fight during the Butterfield Band set, which the press saw, and so they were aware of a turbulence. And so somebody manufactured the rest of it. The Pete Seeger with the fire axe going to cut the cable, garbage.
Were you surprised the first time the blues came?
Yeah, that was at Newport. Well, I did this very crazy thing. So, you know, I mean, I didn't really know what was going to happen. But they certainly booed, I'll tell you that. You could hear it all over the place. I don't know who they were, though. I mean, they must be pretty rich to be able to go someplace and boo.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you all say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and we're continuing to talk about Bob Dylan's Electric Period. And we've been joined by Al Cooper, who was at Dylan's side throughout that entire period. In fact, that's Cooper's Hammond organ you're hearing on Dylan's famous 1965 track, Like a Rolling Stone. That's the game changer for a lot of people. 6-minute single released during the summer of 65. The historians tell us it changed everything. The length of the song, the sound, the fact that Dylan had gone electric full on. He had this amazing guitar player at his side as well, Mike Bloomfield out of Chicago, playing those riffs and fills behind him, the music swelling up and then receding. Dylan at his most caustic, Cooper, an untrained virtuoso, if you will, on that Hammond. He really didn't know what he was doing, but Dylan loved the sound he was getting, and they became comrades in arms ever after. Now, Dylan went on the road soon after playing his electric music to sort of mixed receptions. People weren't quite sure what to make of it, but he was determined to plow ahead. He had found something that had really inspired him not only as a musician, but as a songwriter.
Greg, you know, you made the point earlier. It was an extraordinary period of less than a year and a half that gave us, bringing it all back home, Highway 61. But the real capper was Blonde on Blonde, one of rock's first double albums. I think the single best album in Dylan's canon, and I would say one of the best albums of all time, period. Al, we want to ask you about recording Blonde on Blonde. The sessions began in New York, but then moved to Nashville. It's you, Robbie Robertson, and Dylan. You're joined by a bunch of stellar Nashville session cats, harmonica player, guitarist, and bassist Charlie McCoy, guitarist Wayne Moss, guitarist and bassist Joe South, and drummer Kenny Buttrey.
Yeah.
Now, Al, you've said, and I quote, "Nobody has ever captured the sound of 3 a.m. better than that album. Nobody, even Sinatra, gets it as good." I imagine that's in large part to the recording process. What clicked in Nashville, Al, that hadn't worked in New York?
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time I had gone to another city and played in a recording studio. The musicians were fantastic. They were roughly our age, and they were really nice people. And I don't think they knew who Bob was. And it didn't matter. Then when I heard them play, it was unbelievable. I'd never heard people play like that before. The New York session musicians were very different. On that album, I was music director. And so I would teach the band the songs before Bob got there, and I had arrangement ideas that I would throw out. So that Bob would come like an hour later and we would have one or two songs worked out so he didn't have to sit through us learning the songs. And as we started doing that, I just couldn't believe the finesse and the beauty with which these guys played.
Well, early in the morning, late at night, I got a poison headache. But I feel all right. I'm pledging my time to you, hoping you'll come through too.
You know, here at your case, as a boy from New York, it couldn't have been much more different for Dylan in Tennessee. And while the session musicians were hip and cool and welcoming, I heard you got run out of a record store on a rail by some Tennesseans who wanted to kick your New York butt. Was that hostile outside the studio for Dylan, too? I wonder if that reflected on things.
Well, Bob didn't go out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob was in his hotel and then at the recording studio. And actually, Bob Johnson had gotten one of Elvis's bodyguards to like look after the three of us, myself, Robbie, and Bob. A guy named Lamar Fike, who was fabulous. And he rescued me, and Robbie also in another situation. And my hair wasn't even really long yet.
Al, tell us about those hotel sessions. You and Dylan are in a room. You're on piano. He's writing the songs. How did that go?
Yeah, there were no cassettes invented yet. So Bob asked me to come to his room, and he would teach me the song, the music of the song. Then I would play it on the piano, and he would write lyrics. But I mean, continuously play it for hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got to know the songs prior to the sessions.
The arrangements on that, on those songs are fantastic. The versatility of the band, you were talking about people like Charlie McCoy and Joe South, Kenny Buttrey, these great players, Wayne Moss. I think you told a story once, Al, if I'm not mistaken, about Charlie McCoy balancing the bass guitar and some brass, I think simultaneously while he was playing "You'll Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine," I believe, right? Something like that?
No, that is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just found out that he denies this now.
Yeah.
He said that this didn't happen. But it did. It was very memorable. I mean, you can't make something like that up. We were running down "You Go Your Way," and Charlie said, "I'd like to play that part that you're playing on the organ on the trumpet with you." I said, "That'd be great, but Bob doesn't like to overdub. So unless we get another bass player, I don't know how we could." He says, "I can play the bass and the trumpet at the same time." And now Bob was in the conversation. And so Bob and I cracked up. He said, "No, really." So we started running it down, and the band was playing. And he played with his left hand, you know, the neck of the bass, and thumped down with that. And with his right hand, he played the trumpet at the same time. So he's going like, you know, boom, 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 with his left hand. And with his right, he's going, bum ba da ba da ba da, bum ba da bum 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 bum, like that. So Bob and I were on the floor, just laughing. So Charlie said, "I can do it." So Bob said, "Okay, but just be somewhere where I can't see you."
That's great.
"Say my kisses, and I'd like his. But this time I'm not gonna tell you why that is. I'm just gonna let you pass.
There was a lot of levity and a lot of experimentation during these sessions. Dylan has even been described as demanding a Salvation Army band in one of the tunes, which would become one of the album's standouts, "Rainy Day Women," number 12 and 35. Can you tell us about recording that?
So Kenny Buttrey, the drummer, he played a big bass drum that they had in the back, and I played tambourine. I didn't even play an instrument on that. And I sort of was like the commander of the yelling and screaming. I just read an interview where Bob Johnson says this year that we were marching around the studio and they recorded that. But of course you can't do that. You have to be in one place so you can be mic'd and have headphones on and stuff like that. So we weren't. The only person that could play brass was Charlie McCoy, but he couldn't play two brass at the same time and the bass. So he called up a guy about 1 o'clock in the morning, a trombone player. And at 2 a.m., in comes Wayne, clean shaven with a shirt and tie on. And he unpacks his trombone and Charlie teaches him, you know, blah, 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 blah. And the two of them play, the trombone and the trumpet.
"Well, they'll stone you when you're walking on the street. They'll stone you when you're trying to keep your seat. They'll stone you when you're walking on the floor. They'll stone you when you're walking to the door. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned."
So we did a few takes, and I would say by 2:40 we had a take, and We thanked Wayne, and he packed up his trombone and went home. I thought that was really, the recording of that song was really bizarre.
That's great. How did these Nashville guys react to the fact that these songs were just epic in length? You know, Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands and Stuck Inside a Mobile.
No, nothing like that.
Yeah?
I mean, every day I would talk to Bob on the phone before I went to the studio and say, I'm going to do these songs today. And I always tried to get I Want You in because that was my favorite. And that really was my total arrangement, that song. There was nobody improvised anything except what I'm going to tell you. So Bob wouldn't let me ever do I Want You because he knew how much I liked it. So I think that was the last song that we did on the sessions. So we were running it down and and Wayne Morse goes like a 16th note phrase. I've never heard anyone in New York play anything like that. So I stopped and I said, and we were just rehearsing, and I said, can you do that again? So he did it again. I said, can you play that every time we come to that part in the song?
Mm-hmm.
He said, sure. And I said to myself, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. I want you. I want you so bad.
Honey, I want you. Bob was obviously having a great old time, but there was an incredible amount of pressure on him to produce great records. You guys probably knew you were under a microscope to a degree because he had exploded with Highway 61 Revisited. It must have been an awe-inspiring time in your life.
Well, I did have had one moment where I was working out a part for myself, and I thought to myself, you know, wherever my fingers go, it's going to be forever. And then I said to myself, lock that up, throw it in some dark corner, and go back to whatever you've been doing because it seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
Making Highway 61 was very chaotic, and that's why it sounds the way it sounds. Blonde on Blonde was, you know, like a finely crafted lawn or something. The groundspeople paid attention to everything, and we just tried to play as good as we could play. And when I hear like Memphis Blues again, Joe South is playing guitar on that, and I'm playing organ, and we're sort of trading licks, and it's a very long track. I can't believe that I was 22 years old and played like that on that, and I'd only been playing the organ for less than a year, maybe. It was just inspiring. And the ladies treat me kindly, and they furnish me with tape. But deep inside my heart, I know I can't escape. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
We've been talking about Blonde on Blonde and Dylan plugging in with rock legend and raconteur Al Cooper. Al, it's been a pleasure having you on Sound Opinions.
It's been a pleasure being had. Who says she knows me well? Send a message to find out if she's talked. But the post office has been stolen and the mailbox is locked.
We're going to take a quick break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, and when we return, we're going to highlight two of the best tracks in Dylan history. With the Memphis Blues again. Mona tried to tell me to stay away from the train line. She said that all the railroad men just drink up your blood like wine. And I said, oh, I didn't